Thank you.
Namaste, and it's good to see all of you.
I have a question about doership.
Oh, yes, that lovely, lovely little thing called doership, yes.
As far as doing the mantras, mm-hmm. isn't that doership? Or mm-hmm. how do I differentiate between doership and doing the practices?
Okay, is a different mindset. In doership, it's like, well, I'm going to do this in order to get here. You know, I'm going to do this mantra so that I can get this end. But that's not the mindset that's going to get you to that end. Okay. Because when you're doing this type of mantra, the thing is to start to open up the heart, okay? To do it from the heart and to surrender within the understanding of what is this mantra itself, okay? Do it for what it is, as it is, from the heart. Because the thing is to get the mantra to get you to open up and to go into a new type of a consciousness and to allow it to start to break through, you know, the holdings and the structures that are in place. Okay. So, yeah, we need to have a mind change and change of the focus. Okay. Does it make some sense? Yes? Okay, good. Good. Yeah, I've been having an interesting conversation of late with some people that were in Siddha Yoga and have come to this conclusion that people are really confused what a guru is and what a guru is not and what taking diksha is and what taking diksha is not. And I think that the confusion lies in that people see taking diksha as just another way of gaining some type of external knowledge, like signing up for another college course. You know, well, what's the difference? I can have different teachers and not a problem. Okay. But a guru is not the same as a teacher. Guru means one that is dispelling the darkness. And when people take diksha with an authentic guru, what happens is a type of a relationship is entered. And I tried to explain this to them today. It's like going to the altar and getting married. You don't get married to two wives at one time. You know, you don't try to take care of the two separate places at one time, or you get confusion. And when a guru, an authentic guru, makes a commitment to a sadhaka, they're there to give you their time, their energy, their wisdom, to give you support, to give you guidance, to give you stability as you walk your path. They care about you genuinely. They make a commitment to walk you through the rest of this life and more if it's needed until you reach realization. That what's given by the guru is done out of compassion, not, you know, but I think so many people have been involved with so many of these huge organizations where it's been, you know, just they're buying this course or buying that course, and they're not really having a true guru-chela relationship. So it's become confused. And this is a very sad thing, to exchange something that can be so deep and so precious for something which is being merchandised. And unfortunately, people want to go to the ones that are merchandising it because they give a lot more glitz and glamour and, you know, well, you're taking it with this avatar or that avatar or, you know. So this is... this is something I think that's really being, again, almost lost in the world. Is this true, the Guru-Chela dynamic, the Guru-Chela relationship, this one-to-one? It used to be in the old days that they would accept very few sadhakas. It wasn't mass-produced. Now they've gotten into businesses with a flair of spirituality around it. Okay, I'll give you Shaktipat or I'll give you whatever, but then you're on your own. I'll come out and I'll talk once a week and that's it, you're on your own. And if you get in trouble, this is your problem. Don't come to me, you know. That's not a Guru-Chela relationship. That's mass marketing. And I think what happens is some of these ones, you know, big name gurus, they'll come out and they'll play the part of what people want to see or what people want to hear. I'm just doing it for world peace or I'm, you know. They're fooling the people. Maybe they're honestly deceived themselves, you know, maybe they don't understand what really the commitment is to accept the role of guru, because it takes a lot of commitment. It takes, you know, being willing to give the time to know each of the sadhakas that are coming, to spend time with them one-to-one, to get to know them, how they think, how they respond, how they process. Because in order to be a guru that's dispelling the darkness, you have to understand where the darkness lies and what are the supports of it, you know, so you can help them to break through wherever it is that they're stuck. You know, satsang is wonderful. And coming out and giving flowery things and speaking Advaitic or whatever it is, but that's not what helps to pull away supports for someone. So I hope, I would love to see that we could get more gurus together and to come to some sort of a understanding of what's being lost by this mass marketing and trying to reach as many as you can, because it's becoming so watered down that people are not getting what they could be getting. I think in these types of traditions, it's much better to take fewer sadhakas, only as many as you can honestly work with, so that these sadhakas can go forward to realization. They can break through the bonds, and then we will have people in place that can go on to be gurus, if they so choose. Not all that are sadhakas will go on to be gurus. But I think the world, we need more committed, authentic gurus. And I had one guy today and he wanted to argue the point. I said, you know, authentic gurus, we don't go out and we don't charge for big courses and stuff. And he's going, well, I think you can be authentic and still have that mode. If that were the case, then we'd all be out just charging through the nose. Why not? Why not? Because you can't buy realization. To put a price on it is to cheapen it. What's being offered is this pearl of great price, but you're the one that has to walk the path to get it. It can't be sold. It can't be bought. What is it worth? What is liberation worth? So these attempts at justification for the mass marketing, it's amazing to see. It's disheartening to see. It's disheartening to see when you continue to try to commit to this path, to give this path out of compassion, that people don't understand. Even when it's explained to them, what's the difference? They still don't get it. They still don't understand what's the difference. But I hope that people that are coming here will remain honest to the path, you know, honest within themselves and honest within the integrity of this to keep it as it is. Yes.
I'm a little bit confused. If I had not seen Gangaji on television, which was a mass teaching, I would not have known you. Mm-hmm. I would not have met Janie and asked her, and she wouldn't have led to me. So had I not seen Gangaji, I wouldn't have known you. So in that sense, is there some value to the mass?
It's fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with, you know, having the videos, whatever. That's fine. But there are certain ways paths work, especially the path of Kundalini. Kundalini really needs to have one-to-one. There are other paths. You can do mass. That's fine. If you're just doing bhakti yoga, that's fine. Okay? There's no inherent danger in bhakti yoga. But if you're doing Kundalini and you get wrapped up in this, you have to know what's productive and what's not. In this path especially. Okay, especially in this path. Okay. In the path that Gangaji is doing, I mean, that's fine. It's fine. But yeah, even in that, it's better to work one-to-one with people. I mean, she's good at what she does when she's up there, and I've seen her working with people and trying to get them to finally just stop. And try to stop covering over and running away and just really sit with what's there and go beneath it and beyond it. But it takes more than just one session to do that. It needs to be a continual thing. Now, if she's continually working with sadhakas like that, then yeah, you can break through. But people for that type of a thing need to be ripe. They need to be ready for it. Okay? I understand what she's doing, you know, and she's very good at what she does. Her husband, on the other hand, is not as proficient as she is, you know. But I see what she's doing, and it has value. Okay, it has value. But what I'm speaking of is the Kundalini path, because this path in itself has some ways you can go really, really off on if you don't understand what's happening. You can't mass market Kundalini and leave people to their own devices. If they don't have good foundational knowledge, they can get into some real problems. Okay. There's another guy I just recently got a video of, and he's teaching pranayama, and he's very popular over in India now. He's in Haridwar. And this guy is teaching all these pranayams, you know, the one where you go from side to side, and then the heavy one, and then... Well, I said, yeah, this is great for diabetes, but it'll also awaken Kundalini. Oh, wonderful. He's giving this out to stadiums full of people with no other guidance what to do with it if it opens. They're doing it for health. Most of these people that are going to him want to have health, you know. Well, it clears out this and it clears out that. It can aid with this. It can help you lose weight. It can help with diabetes and help with all these different things. But it can also awaken Kundalini. Well, people kind of bypass that part, what he's saying. And they're thinking, well, I'm just doing it for health reasons, so no problem. But what happens when the Kundalini awakens and all of a sudden they're starting to do mudras and spontaneous yoga moves and mantras, and all these fears and repressed things start coming up and they don't know what to do with it? They'll think they're losing their minds. And then you start having changes in the body, and you start having changes in consciousness, and you start having a lot of, you know, extreme experiences from what you're used to. And if you don't have a foundation in place, you can have a problem. So what I'm speaking of is this path directly, Kundalini path. Siddha gurus, above all, need to have integrity. There was a reason why this is only given out, and why it said you don't do this path on your own. And when you're doing it mass-produced, Shaktipat, that's basically giving it to them and having them do it on their own. It's never been recommended. Never. I think bhakti yoga is fine. You can do that mass marketed. Not a problem. Okay. But this path. This is why I committed to work in this path, because I went through that dynamic for 30 plus 40 years. It was very difficult. At that time, I would have given anything to find a guru to help guide me through it. And there were none. And now when I see that this has become like the new popular in thing, and it's becoming mass marketed, and they're awakening people, but they're not giving any help, any aid. And they're taking a lot of money for this. And then leaving people in suffering and worse off than they were before. This is unconscionable. This is not being a guru. This is not being a light. This is not dispelling darkness. This is creating more confusion, more bondage, more pain, more suffering. And the guru's job is to aid one to come out of suffering, to find that which one is at the core. So I am very, very concerned with what's taking place in the world now. And gurus are having such bad names because of what's happened with Osho, what's happened with Muktananda, and what's happened with all these big name gurus, that organizations have grown up around them, and one was, you know, they were having armed guards in there and poisoning people, and Muktananda was, you know, and Sai Baba groping and fondling the men and raping them. And I really feel sorry for those teachers, because they will have such heavy karma. I think gurus are under much more stringent values than sadhakas that are coming, because they're in a position of authority. They're responsible for what they're giving, and what it's an awesome responsibility to take on the guidance of someone. You're responsible for what you're giving to them. This is not something anyone should take lightly. It's a very difficult undertaking. And it's really something you know, when you're told it's time for you to be a guru, by this time, you know, the illusions about it are gone. The Messiah complex about it is gone. You understand what the ramifications of it are. Okay. That we take on a very heavy responsibility to people. I take this very seriously. And this is why it's so stringent that no, if you take Diksha here, you can't go take Diksha somewhere else, because I can't, you know, I can't be responsible for what you're being told somewhere else. It's not out of ego that I don't want you going here or there. That has nothing to do with it. I'm responsible. If I take you on as a sadhaka, I am responsible for your growth. The buck stops here. Okay? It's a heavy responsibility. It's not like being a teacher that's teaching a course and I'm just going to give you this information, and what you do with it, you do with it. Oh, well, it's in your court. And that's unfortunately what most of these gurus are doing. They don't hold themselves any way accountable or any responsibility for what's being given and how it's affecting the people there. But I take this very seriously, okay? I care for every one of my sadhakas as if they were my children, okay? I want to see your growth, okay? I want to see you come out of the bondage you're in, okay? I don't want to have a gaggle of people just hanging on me. I don't need that. Okay, that's not what this is about. Part of being a responsible guru is to cut the strings when they need to be cut. Okay. The hard, sometimes hard discipline that goes with it, the 2x4, when it's needed. If there's too much grasping or clinging or whatever, then you need the 2x4 sometimes. Well placed. And I won't hesitate. But it's done with love. Because I want to see your growth. You know, I want to see you come out of it. I don't want people sitting here and making me some kind of a figurehead and praying to, you know, praying to this figurehead. I've been reading lately the book that's I'm the Mother of a God, the one about Andrew Cohen. And it comes to the part in the book where he says, "Yes, I'm now a God. I feel like a God." I was like, it's a very sad story. Sad. You read this and it's very sad. He's not a God. A guru is not a God. I am not a God. If nothing else, after realization, you become more ordinary because there's only God. There is no you. What a God. There's only God. I'm a God and you are a worm, crawl over, you know. No. One reaches realization and you become nothing. Ordinary. Huh? You're not something special. This is what everyone is at the core. What I am, you are. Huh? And we understand that all these failings and all of these sorrows and all of these things, you know, that we've come out of, this is, you know, everyone is in that same mess, in that same soup, in that same stew. Okay? But we don't, you don't need to be. And this is what's recognized. You know, what we're seeking for is already here. It's always been here. Without it, we would have no life. But it's so covered over. So the guru's job is to dispel that darkness. Doesn't mean that you're going to find some light. The light's already there, but it's covered over. Okay? We're the dispeller of darkness. That's what guru means, the dispeller of darkness. The light's already there. Okay? It's just tinted. Sometimes it's tinted very darkly, but but it's there. It's there. The freedom is there. And this is the unfortunate thing, because it is freedom and because the absolute is the seed of creation. Infinite potential. Where your mind is set, that's where you're going. And unfortunately, people's minds are skewed to chasing all sorts of things which cause bondage. So they're creating and sustaining this nonsense. So latched on to these fears and these trepidations and, you know, that it keeps them going on these hamster wheels. And the way to break through the hamster wheel is to stop running. Yeah, Gangaji's right. It's to be still, but people don't know how to be still. This is the problem. How to be still and how to start to pull away those supports which support ego, but they keep covering over what's there. Eventually we need to stop and we need to face these fears and the trepidations and these things and find out that they really don't have the hold on us. They're not the reality. They are the constructed images of our making, the constructed boogeymans. It's like being paralyzed with fear as a kid because the boogeyman is in the closet or under the bed or something and you're too scared to go look. It's the same thing. Eventually we have to stop and finally get up and go look. And once we look, we find out it's not there. That's what the path is, finally stopping and looking at the boogeyman to find out it's not there. People are so busy. You see them in their lives. They can't stand to sit still for one moment. I've got to run to this or run to that or this party or that party or buy this or buy that or, you know, take this course or that course, and I always need to be doing something. Is silence, is stillness so fearful? Ask what's fearful in it. What is it you're going to confront and see by staying still and just sitting for a while without chasing here or there? The other question that had come up, Champa called from Virginia Beach, and she was asking, she said, well, what is awakening? What is that? What are the symptoms of it? How can one tell if there's an awakening in place? Sometimes when this, when Kundalini is beginning to stir, an awakening will feel vibrations in the body. You might see light. You might hear the nod, this internal sound. You can become very, very acutely aware in all of your senses. Sounds can seem so loud. Okay. Everything that is experienced is suddenly experienced to an acute degree. You can start to have shifts of conscious awareness. At one second you'll feel real small, and the second you'll feel real tall, another second, you know, things will change. Things will change. All of a sudden, these emotions which have been repressed may start to come up. When you start noticing the mind, all of a sudden it seems to go faster. You can begin to sometimes have extrasensory perception. Things occur, like understanding, you know, what people's thoughts are, or you can feel what's happening in another person's body. So many things can take place when the Kundalini becomes active. Some people have more, some people have less. It's always different for every person. Some may feel more of the energy in the body. You might have feeling one side, it might be cold one time, another time it might be hot, another time it just feels like energy just moving, ants crawling through the body, or you feel it moving in different ways. So these are just some of the things that take place when Kundalini is awakened. Do any of you have anything else to add for what you notice when it started awakening for you?
Well, one thing that you didn't mention that I see a lot is images. And I know Swami Siddhananda has mentioned that too. Mm-hmm. Pictures, images, for me, they can be kind of violent. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of just knowing, I feel that they probably came from my past lives or something in this life. Mm-hmm. And the growing detachment from that, that's mm-hmm. one thing I've noticed.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, some people become very visual. Some people are not visual at all. Was there anything else? Was there something you want to say?
I just feel my body.
Okay. Yeah.
I just first felt it in my body with the shaking in my spine where I, you know, didn't control it. It just spontaneously happened. And that's the first thing that I felt. And now I feel hot and cold in my spine every once in a while after meditation and when I'm stretching and stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Lena?
Mine was mostly doing mantras that I didn't know, and I didn't speaking in other languages that I didn't know.
Yeah, spontaneous mantras or spontaneous bij mantras, that can happen as well. So there are a lot of different things that can take place in an awakening. For some, it's more subtle, and for some, it's very pronounced. Okay, so not all of these things may be going on at the same time. And like I said, for some it's very, very subtle, and for some it can be earth shattering. In my case, when I sat down to meditate and I felt that vibration, and then it just went, it was very earth shattering, and it didn't stop for 30 years. It was ongoing from that point. But, yeah. So I hope this helps for those that were wanting to know what happens when the Kundalini awakening begins to take place. Do we have any other questions, comments today? It's so quiet over there. Then at this point, we'll go ahead and take a break. We have tea and lots of fruit out there today. So we'll have a quick break, and then we'll reconvene for meditation. So namaste, and thank you for coming.